this week on The Inside Flap.
Now, here's a confession coming from a mystery writer. Before I began to write mysteries, I didn't read them. That was the influence of my high school English teaching father, who convinced me that mysteries were the poor stepchildren of literature.
I didn't even read
Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys when I was growing up.
At one point, I said to the kids, I said, "For all you do not know me, for all you know, I am a stranger on the street." And then I jumped out of the window, as we're on the ground level, and there's like a little courtyard right there. And then I leaned into the classroom, and I was like, "Look at me. I am stranger on street. You do not know."
That is crazy. The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the table to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And resting comfortably on the floral settee on the other side of the snack shack is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior!
Oh, it's back! It's back! Yes, you brought it back. Very good.
He had some complaints.
Thank you for joining us. This is episode 137 of
The Inside Flap.
The Inside Flap, our book podcast with book recommendations.
Book reviews!
And the
audiobook of the week.
As well as today, we're joined by William Kent Krueger, the best-selling author of the Cork O'Connor mystery series. His standalone novel, Ordinary Grace, which I read and loved also, it won the Edgar Award in 2013 for Best Mystery. His new book is titled Lightning Strike. I had a really nice conversation with him about it and a lot more. And did you know that he used to work for the Denver Parks Department?
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we chatted about that. We chatted about the Boy Scouts. It was good. It was a good conversation. Just a delight to talk to, and we'll have that for you in just a second. But first, well, it was a big day for me today, as it was at my new school, the first official back-to-school day with all the students. Specifically, I should mention that now I have over 150 students in which I have to learn all their names. But the thing about the biggest thing I'm afraid of is trying to get a hold of all these names, because they're all new to me. Most of them are freshmen. Obviously, it's a new school, so I don't know anybody. So now I got to learn, all these names, which has always been a hassle. And now you add masks. All the kids are wearing masks now, too. So it's even harder, you know.
You know, it's funny. You look at, like, the sitcoms. Like Welcome Back, Carter.
Yeah,
you know, Sydney Poitier to Sir with Love.
Wow, that was a great sitcom. I love that. Do you remember?
Oh,
that
not sitcom, a sitcom, but you know, what do they have? Like 15 students in the classroom.
I know exactly. Yeah, let's get a little reality. Yeah, head Sylvia, of the class. Sylvia's how many school. Did they have in head of the class?
Yeah.
Oh, this. What about Sylvia's school?
I mean, she's got like 15 in a lot of her classes. It depends on the school.
They cap it at 35, so that's going to be a lot of fun. To deal with, the last couple days we met with the freshmen and the sophomores.
I mean, I can't even remember 35 president names.
Yeah. When Andrew was telling me the human brain can only handle, what is it?
So it's a scientifically proven fact. It's a study that came out maybe 5 years ago, but it's saying that the human mind can only manage like 192 relationships.
Oh.
Right. And that once you know, if you get behind that level, I guess it goes down in efficiency. And so the number's like 190 something. I think it's like 192.
You mean interpersonal relationships?
Yeah, correct.
Hmm.
Wow. How do politicians do that?
They don't.
They don't. Yeah. They have a handler. Like if you watch Veep, they have a handler, Tony Hale, who comes and whispers
Hale,
the name.
The name whisperer. He would lean. That is Jack Ryan. He likes surfboarding. His daughter is a freshman. You know, and he would whisper all the information. That's what I need. I need a Tony Hale to lean over my shoulder and whisper in my ear the names of all these kids. I got three. Well, one easy way to remember it. My last period, I had three Allies. So that's good.
Wow.
So not just Allie. Well, we determined a double A, triple A, and then just Allie. Because the one girl, her first and last name is, it starts with an A. So she's the double A.
Oh.
And then we have the other Allie is, she just went with triple A, and then we have the original Allie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Allie McBeal? What are these, I wonder why that name's up.
I don't know. Maybe, yeah. Allie McBeal was
that was a long
was that
time
popular
ago.
15 years ago?
No.
I don't think so.
That was like 35 yeah, that was years ago, a long time feels ago. Like. Right? That was a long time ago. Yeah.
I don't know. So that was today. Everybody came in today. Now, I had met with most of the kids on Monday. We had a quick little wrap around where they would go to all their classes for just 10 minutes. And what I did, what I like to do, and for anybody out there listening who maybe you have a group of strangers you have to introduce yourself to, here's a little tip for you. This is what I like to do. I like to get into character. In this instance, he sounds a lot like Borat. So every time the kids would come in, I would talk to them all like this. And we would, the whole time. And, you know, they left the room without knowing who I really was. And, you know, the fun part is when you start talking like this, you just say all kinds of random stuff. Like, I would be right in the middle of talking. I'd be like, I'd pause and go, who like ice cream? I like ice cream. Who like ice cream?
Oh, man.
Just the more you do it, the sillier it gets. At one point, I said to the kids, I said, for all you do not know me, for all you know, I am a stranger on the street. And then I jumped out of the window because we're on the ground level. And there's like a little courtyard right there. And then I leaned into the classroom and I was like, look at me. I am stranger on street. You do not know.
That is crazy.
And then I had a little problem getting back in.
I was
in.
Wondering about that.
And I was like, little help, little help, little help.
The
and everybody's just,
help
no,
you?
They just stared at me.
Oh, then I, they
like,
stared.
I deliberately kind of like awkwardly came in and I was like, thank you so much for help. Not at all. Everybody
oh,
gets F. And so, you know, just crazy stuff like that. And I thought it would be fun to create a little backstory for this guy. So I wrote up last night, I showed it to you guys, a little slideshow, you know, replete with grammatical mistakes. I had like a picture of an old schoolhouse that I was going to say I had previously taught at. Well, then I go in this morning. And first of all, well, nothing like starting your day, your first day with kids at a new school and not having the key to your room. I couldn't find the room key anywhere because, you know, my parents are in town. They had my car, and so I didn't have a place to put the room key. It was just, you know, on its own, and it turned out it was in Sylvie's car, but I went the whole day without the room key. I get there, and, you know, it took me a while because I didn't realize how bad the traffic was going to be around the school. 2,600 kids in the school. It was a nightmare getting there. So I'm, like, frantically rushing up.
Kids I can imagine
are
that.
Already waiting outside, waiting
door?
To get
you
in.
You were late on the first day?
I wasn't late, but I was cutting it close.
How early?
I had to run around.
Wait, how much time did you get there before class started?
I had like 5 minutes.
Okay,
yeah,
that's late.
Which
that's
is
late.
Way,
that's late.
Way, way, way yeah. too close. So I had to run around. I go to the guy next door. I'm like, you got a key to this room? He said, no, they're all different. You need to find an administrator.
Oh. My
so I don't want to go up to my AP the first day of school and be like,
and
hey, I'm
key.
The new guy. I lost my key. Can you let me into my room? So I race up to Paige's room. And thankfully, the music teacher was there. And she, who's actually going to be using my room one period, had a key. So thankfully,
I ran up, ran down.
You need to make some copies.
Yeah, well, I found it. But yeah, maybe I
make some copies.
Andrew's yeah. right.
Yeah, yeah, maybe I think I should.
Yeah.
So you know what?
Give it to Paige.
So
I've got Paige a copy.
Yeah,
I've got an ID card.
Yeah,
and I've got it, and so for work. And so what I always do, so I don't forget it, is the ID card stays in my car. Right, drive the same car to work.
You gotta have tricks
like
that.
The ID card ID stays in the car.
Yeah.
Well, what do you wear it around your neck?
Oh, no, no. I clip it on. It's a clip on.
It's a classic clip on. It's a classic clip on.
His IDs, like he likes his ties. Yep. Yeah, I've got the key card to get into the building, but I just keep that in my wallet. The key is now on my key ring, but it was because I was driving Sylvia's car. Yeah.
Different
and
car.
She didn't have a key ring on her key. But anyway, I finally got in, and the first kid who's there, I started doing the shtick, hello, welcome. He stops.
Oh.
He looks at me, and he goes, well, when are you going to break this character?
Really?
I'm like, all right, okay, fine. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
well,
wow.
I got to know him a little more. He's a no-nonsense kind of guy.
Oh, okay.
Good kid. I like him, but he's like,
plain talking.
Why don't you just break character?
Plain talking.
I'm like, you do not like this? He goes, it got a little repetitive. I said, okay, fair enough.
I could see it being a little annoying because you're not sure what to do. Do I humor him? Yeah, what do I do?
It's the official first day. You can't go back to the same character. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I just did.
Well, there went that lesson plan.
Drop it. Yeah, you got to when you're.
That was those 10 minutes.
You when you're a teacher, you have to think on the fly. So yeah. You always have stuff. You always have.
Yeah, I mean, you were 5 minutes, 10 minutes late to class, so that ate up.
I was not 10 minutes, and that you're right. That did take
that
up time.
Ate up some time.
Good point.
Did you tell the kids what had happened?
No, I'm not gonna. No, I did not tell them what happened.
That's
I'm
so
still
weird.
Getting. I can't. You can't come right off the bat with saying all your faults to them. You know.
I know. Just wonder. I've never.
Hi, I'm your teacher. I'm an idiot. I can't keep track of a single key. I locked out of my room this morning. I should have kept the windows unlocked. I can jump in and out of the windows, for goodness sakes. All right, but anyway, that's the update. Day one. Long day, man, long day. Over 150 kids, a lot of talking. My voice is, I don't know if you can tell, but it's a little bit hoarse. It's going.
You might
it's
lose going. It this week.
I might. You got to get back into teacher. We call that teacher shape. You need to get your teacher voice going.
So, you know, Colorado, it's dry out here.
That's true.
And I had, the first couple of years I moved out here, I had a problem where I lost my voice. And there was one point where I lost my voice for like 3 months.
Whoa.
Right? You call that the golden days. Remember that?
that's what my wife calls it. That's right. And so, you know, and the only way to get it back is to stop using it. Mm-hmm. And so what I actually learned to whistle like once for yes, twice for no.
What?
And so,
why did we not know this?
I actually remember it.
Yeah.
I do remember. Now I'm thinking about this before the podcast.
Vaguely familiar.
I remember when you had a horrific problem with your voice.
Yeah. But here's the dry air and stuff like that. But anyways, my family was so annoyed. It's like, please don't whistle. Please,
I would have been
incredibly
annoyed.
Don't whistle anymore.
Yeah. The whistling would have driven me insane.
And then you guys will remember, what was it? Maybe episode 15 or whatever, when the teacher strike was going on.
And you lost your voice.
And I lost my voice.
Like, completely lost it.
Yeah, and I couldn't even...
That was the first time I've ever heard you, Dave Medicus, lose your voice.
Yeah, it was all the chanting, all the protesting.
All the chanting.
That was very exciting.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's how it's going over at East. Laura, how has your week been?
It's been good. We had... we had the quintessential American small town parade.
It really was.
On Saturday.
Yeah. And Andrew joined us.
Andrew came out. His kids came out. Dave's parents were here. My parents were here. And so it was Sylvia's very first parade as a member of a marching band. So she got to march in the parade.
We got audio of them.
Oh, wow. Oh, hey. Yeah. Classic song, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it's like exactly what you think. Babies, balloons losing in the air. I think one of your kids lost a balloon.
Both of them.
Well, yeah.
And I told him, I said, you know, kids, well, there's a 99.9% likelihood that you're going to lose your balloon one of two ways. It's going to pop, or it's going to end up in the air. Yeah.
Pop is the worst, though, because it scares you to death.
And Mary-Kate, she dropped hers at the tea shop, and it went up to the ceiling. The high ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was just like, I had a smile on my face.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It was exciting. Just super cool to see it. Some highlights from the parade. One is there's three drum majors that lead the high school band.
Yes.
And I won't say which one, but one of them tossed their mace, which is the like big wand kind of thing that I don't know why they carry.
The big baton has got the big metal ball on the top of it. Yeah,
tossed their mace up into the air and then proceeded to drop it.
Yeah.
And Sylvia told me that the whole crowd broke out into laughter. And that, because the trombones are right behind the drum majors, mm-hmm. the trombones really lead the parade,
yes,
with the drum
do.
Majors.
76 trombones led the big parade.
The whole trombone section collapsed into laughter had trouble getting through their next song because they were laughing so hard. And then I saw this individual coming down the street, mm-hmm. and this person had a deer in headlights look when they, because I saw them toss up the thing, and I thought, I can't say the name. Oh, Alex looks a little nervous here. That's not his real name.
Right.
Or her real name.
Yeah, or her.
And I wondered. I was like, Sylvie, did everything go okay? Did anyone drop anything?
Funny you should mention that.
And she's
that.
Like, oh, yeah. Alex dropped their mace.
You gotta practice with that mace. I mean, that's
it's nerves.
Big. It's unwieldy.
It's
and
nerves.
It's nerves. You're in front of a crowd for the first time.
Yeah. And then the other thing that happened is... I went, even though we can walk to the downtown area, which is great, Sylvie did not want to walk back home in her full marching band regalia.
Right.
So I went ahead of time and I parked at the community college there, which is where all, they had like one parking lot was filled with horse trailers, another parking lot had buses, and then it was filled with parking. So I felt pretty proud of myself. I saw the school bus parking lot and I was like, well, this is where her marching band's going to end. Other marching bands are going to end here. I like backed into a spot again. I felt great about backing into a spot in the shade. Pleased.
Sure.
Yeah, dusted my hands off.
There you go.
Walked away.
Right.
Came back to go get her. And as I'm approaching the parking lot, I pretty much screwed myself because I like to be in the middle of things and I like to feel included in things.
Mm-hmm.
I see hundreds of children, teenagers in marching band uniforms, like right around my car. Like they're all gathering so that they can be counted and probably get on their bus.
Oh,
they're milling around. They've got their instruments. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of things. And I just thought, I'm not going to be
You're
able
trapped.
To get out of this parking lot. Because it's not like it's 30 people. It's hundreds of people milling around.
There were a lot of schools there in the parade.
Yes, there were a lot of schools in the parade. And I...
They were all by your car.
All by my car. And I would not have gotten out if it... Like, I was one car clear that I was able to get out.
Mm.
And I just had to move forward a little bit. And like one kid saw me and move forward. But there wouldn't have been a way to clear that many... Teenagers.
Wait, you just got to lay on that horn. These are kids, man. Just lay on the horn.
It was so many, Sylvie would have died of embarrassment. Like, I don't know what I would have done.
She could duck.
I mean, it was brutal.
That's the problem. Yeah, when you're with a kid, you can't do that.
So, you know, the Littleton Parade was great because it was the basics. It was the marching bands.
Yeah, it's the basics.
Right? It wasn't crazy. In contrast to, like, the Golden Parade, which goes on for like hours, and they've got like old people with walkers.
They call it Buffalo Bill Days, is what the Golden Parade
They've got like
is
old,
called.
I mean, no exaggeration, they have like old people and walkers.
Yeah.
I mean, they have people walking their little chihuahuas.
You think you'll never, you almost feel like you've lived through three or four different parades.
Oh, yeah.
So that parade, and also what they do, every business in town gets their own float, except it's just like, usually like a car with a decal. Bob's window washing
they
riding
have,
by.
Now
that
I think about
that
it,
parade is terrible.
They have librarians even walking with their carts in that parade.
Oh, don't let Amy Del Po hear you say that.
Well, it's cute, but at the same time, you've
Library
seen
corner.
Like 1,500 other floats, and you're like, why do we need to have this? We don't.
Yeah. My memories of that parade are just simply...
They're bad.
How ridiculous that parade is.
Yeah, and then every Christmas in Golden, we're talking about Golden, Colorado, which is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Every Christmas, every single Saturday,
every
they have a Christmas
Saturday
parade.
Every Saturday in December,
Yeah, which those Christmas parades are short and sweet, so that's okay, but it's every single Saturday.
It's just the corporate sponsorship that I find really annoying.
Yeah, it is annoying. Yeah, but it was nice to see Andrew... And
it was
family.
Great. My parents were in town. Good to see them. They got to see Sylvia marching in the parade. A good time was had by all.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
Weather was
Except
nice.
For the kid who probably dropped the mace and is still reliving that moment.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday, I'll get to have more stories from the State Fair parade.
Oh, that's right.
And I have a feeling that one will be more like the Golden Parade, Andrew, where it just goes on forever.
Yeah. It's going to be the big State Fair parade.
Yeah. Andrew, how are you?
Good. Everything's good. You know, it's... never uneventful.
No.
You know, and it's funny because, like, money's a little tight right now. And so I told Peter, I'm like, Peter, my bank account is negative. So, you know, so we can't really go spending some money. So then a couple of days later, he's like, Dad, exactly how negative is your account? And then he's like, and how much do you get paid, Dad? Because he wanted to calculate how long it would be.
You shouldn't have told that lie.
He wanted to calculate, well, how long is it going to be before you actually have got money to spend again, Dad? He wanted
the spreadsheet.
He wanted to do the math. Now, I work at a financial institution.
Mm-hmm.
I started a new job 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And last week, like, the senior vice president in charge of my department resigned.
Right.
My boss, like, you know, from one moment to the next, he resigned last week. You know, and so, like, now I've been pulled into a new team. That team is being pulled into another organization. But it's just like, you know, corporate America, man, it's just unbelievable. I don't know how corporations are successful with it just as much.
I don't either.
Turmoil.
That is true. How
I
are
about
any,
that too?
Because you get on here every week, and it's just another baffling thing about.
I don't
your,
think it's
your
that particular corporation. I think it's most
corporations
are that way.
I would agree.
Yeah, and even when I think about like small businesses, like they're not run that well either.
No, some of them are.
Some of them are, but some of them aren't.
Yeah. So like,
I mean, I don't have an MBA. I never took a single business class in my entire life. And I have my own business.
You have your own business.
And that's dumb.
True.
That's dumb.
That really is not very smart.
No.
So I had a graduate professor, right? Mm-hmm. And this guy was like from Brooklyn. And, you know, he spoke with a Brooklyn accent.
Oh,
and stuff
forget
like that.
About it.
And he did not look like your typical professor. This guy was maybe 280 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Broad shoulders. I mean, really, this guy looked like he was a linebacker.
Okay.
Right? But he told stories in this like business management class. He told stories, and one of his favorite stories was the hot dog vendor.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us one of his tricks in New York. He's like, well, you know, these guys that run the hot dog carts, a lot of them, it's their business.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, the price might be $3 for a hot dog. He's like, but here's a trick I like to use. He's like, you know, that hot dog only costs them 50 cents. And so, sure, they want to sell them for $3. But you know what? Sometimes when it's really slow, I'll walk by and I'll be like, $1.50. And, you know, and the guy, and he's like, and most of the time, you know, he'll take the $1.50, you know, but it's because the hot dog vendor it's his business. He knows he's still making money. It's a slow day. And he'd rather see the $1.50 than to basically see nothing. But
how cheap is your graduate professor? I mean, really? The guy can't chill out $3 to a hardworking hot dog vendor?
Well, you got to appreciate
the bartering,
the gimmick.
I don't know.
You know, and you know, if you go to New York, you go to see where's a hot dog. You can let's give this a try.
All right, well, Laura
listeners,
and I
give it
and
a try.
Sylvia, we're going to New York in December, so we'll have to try.
I have sworn off.
Hot dogs or vendors?
Those types of hot dogs. I don't think I can eat another one in my life.
Oh, yeah.
I really don't. I used to like them. Like when we lived in New York City, mm-hmm. on my lunch break, I mean, I probably limited it to twice a week. I would go to Central Park on my lunch break and I would buy a hot dog and a pretzel.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm done with the hot dogs. I'm here to say. I'll buy a pretzel. Last pretzel I had in New York was terrible too. And I was really disappointed. Because I had good memories of the soft pretzel with the mustard.
Yeah, you got to have the mustard.
Wiener, wiener, chicken diner.
All right. Well, speaking of winners, our guest this week is William Kent Kruger. His new book is Lightning Strike. And boy, I really enjoyed this book. This is a prequel to the Cork O'Connor mystery series, the long-running series. This one goes back in time to when Cork is but a wee lad of 14. His father is the sheriff, and his mother, if you're familiar with the series, you know that Cork O'Connor is part Ojibwe and part Irish, and the Ojibwe part comes from his mother. If you're already a fan of this series, you're going to love this one. It's so interesting and fun to see him as a young boy, and you get to meet a lot of the series regulars. And if you're not already familiar with the books, well, this is a great entry point. You really see, you know, Kruger dives into the prejudice, and he does in all these books, but in this one in particular, the prejudice that natives live with, and we see it in a very real and powerful way that just resonates here and brings you into this world that he's created, the small town of Aurora, Minnesota, located among beautiful forests on the shores of Iron Lake. And I just love the way he writes about nature. I was telling him about that. It just once me makes me want to get outside and maybe even go visit Minnesota.
Oh, I'd like to see Minnesota. I've never been there.
Especially the North Minnesota. Like some of those lakes up there.
The
pristine.
The Upper Peninsula.
No, that's Michigan.
Oh, that's Michigan. That's
Upper, Upper Peninsula, Michigan.
Well, forget about Minnesota.
Nah, forget Minnesota. Yeah. The storyline of this book.
I've heard they have beautiful... Okay, so I'm a designer.
It is the land of a thousand lakes,
so they have beautiful lake cabins there. And so I'm a big fan of the Minnesotan lake cabin.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. You got any...
I just was looking at one today, actually.
Yes, and there might be some cabins in this book as well.
There should be. It's a Minnesotan tradition.
The storyline is about a beloved figure in the community who has hanged himself. And in fact, the young Cork, discovers the body. But the real mystery is why this man, who seemed to have it all together and was well-respected, why would he kill himself? But more than just the... And it is a really fascinating mystery in the way he goes. I like how we see the beginnings of a budding detective as Cork, almost with his friends, almost Hardy Boys-esque style, tries to stay one step ahead of his father, the sheriff, as they both try to, you know, kind of solve the mystery. The story is obviously much more than that. This is a story about the Ojibwe people and the injustices they have faced and still face, and also the story of, you know, what it means to be a father. And I just love hearing the relationship between Cork and his father. It really shines in this book. And I just kind of found that relationship heartwarming. This is a sweetly poetic and graceful meditation on life, fatherhood, and community. I found extremely compelling and just a delight to read. And it was a delight talking to the author himself. So here he is. This talking about his book, Lightning Strike, is William Kent Kruger. And all your charms, whenever I want you, all I have to do is dream. Dream, dream, dream when I feel blue. I'm in Littleton, Colorado, just south of Denver.
Sure, I know Littleton. I lived in Denver for about 10 years.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, very nice.
In fact, if you go up to Denver proper, a great many of the parks you'll see up there, I had a hand in building. I worked for the Denver Department of Parks and Recreation for almost a decade, back in my younger days.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Now, so you can tell me where the bodies are buried in Cheeseman Park then.
love Cheeseman Park.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. That's great. That's very, very cool. How about that? You write about, it's no wonder you write about a natural landscape so well. You know, I loved your book, Enlightening Strike. You described all the different, the nature, the boundary waters, the canoeing. It really made me want to grab a boat and, you know, a paddle. You know, not a whole lot of that going on around here, unfortunately. Do you get out? Do you do a lot of canoeing or kayaking?
Not as much as I used to, or as much as I would like. But yeah, I've been a canoeist all my life. I was a Boy Scout. Learned how to canoe very early. And in Minnesota, you know, we have such beautiful water here, lakes and wonderful rivers. So yeah, if you don't canoe, you're missing out on a lot of what the land offers you up here.
That's great. I thought maybe, you know, I was going to ask you if you were a Boy Scout, because, you know, you mentioned it in the book. I was a little worried for a second there where I was going to go with the Scouts. I was a Scout myself. What rank did you get up to?
Do you know, I was 2 merit badges shy of Eagle.
Oh, no. Come on. Really?
Yep.
Damn.
Yeah, I dropped out before I got that distinction.
I got to Star. And then what held me back was all the service projects you had to do. I just like going camping and hanging out, going on hikes.
You know, your scouting experience depends a whole lot on the troop that you're a part of. And I was part of a really active troop. So, you know, we were always out doing the service projects and all of that. Not a problem at all.
We had like this redneck guy who was our scout master. He just liked to go camping. So that's what we did.
You know, nothing wrong with that.
No, the greatest life lesson. Well, first of all, the greatest lesson you can learn, I think, is to be prepared. You know, you learn that at a very, and it's just one of the, just a great motto and a great thing to learn. And so many things that scouting had taught me, just how to interact with others and, you know, everything about nature. So I will, like, not unlike Keith Richards, who also credits the Boy Scouts with his.
Seriously.
Yes, he does. Yeah. In his book,
Life. Huge.
He does. He spent like the first in his autobiography. He spent like the first two chapters talking about how much scouting meant to him. I was like, damn.
Yeah, unfortunately, scouting has been the name has been besmirched of late, which is too bad because for so many of us, it really was an extraordinary experience. Really, a part of shaping us into who we are. Who we are today.
And look at us now. Look at us now. Look at you, a famous writer. And me, a middling high school drama teacher. Now, so let's talk about your book.
Nothing middling about being a high school drama teacher. My father was a high school drama teacher.
Come on. Are you serious? Really?
Seriously. Oh. He taught English and he was also in charge of speech. But he was in charge of the drama program for the small high school that he taught at and where I went.
That's great. Oh, really? Did you have your dad as a teacher?
Indeed, I did.
How was that for you?
You know, actually, it wasn't too bad. He was pretty conscious not to, not to play favorites or anything. And he was a good teacher. Everybody thought he was a good teacher. So not a problem.
That's great. It's great to be, I used to be an English teacher, now a drama teacher. It's great. And you are, again, I believe, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't believe this, teaching lessons that will continue and permeate for the rest of your life. So that's a great thing about teaching drama.
Yeah.
So you're right. Well, I will not denigrate my own character. Thank you for pointing that out to me.
Bravo. God bless you for the good work you're doing.
And God bless you, William Kent Krueger, for your new book, Lightning Strike. Good God, this one hit me. This was really emotionally resonant. Really good. I really, really love this one. The origin story, if you will, for Cork O'Connor. Also the book that finally answers the question, who was inside the monster suit in The Thing from Another World? Finally, we got to the bottom of this one. And the answer may surprise you.
You never knew that?
Somehow escaped me. So what was it?
I'm glad I taught you something.
Yes, at least I learned that from your book. If nothing else, what was it that inspired you to go back and write a prequel to the Cork O'Connor books?
Actually, it was the suggestion of my agent, who has always wanted me to go back and revisit Cork or visit Cork as a very young man. Because across there, for those folks who might be listening who really aren't really very familiar with my work, I write a very long-running mystery series that features a guy named Cork O'Connor. He's a man of mixed heritage. He's part Irish-American and part Ojibwe. There are currently 17 novels in the series. This is number 18 coming out, Lightning Strike. Mm. And very often in the course of the stories, I have referred to experiences that Cork had as a kid, and particularly experiences with his father that were important in shaping Cork. But I've only alluded to them, and she has always wanted me to go back and explore that territory more deeply. And so I thought, okay, it's time. I didn't have another story idea, so I thought, okay, let's do it.
Did you get, it sounds like you might have been kind of dragged, kicking and screaming into it since it took you a while?
Not actually. No. I don't want it to sound like that. It was just that I had so many other priorities, and finally it came time to, okay, the decks are cleared. I really don't have another idea. And yeah, this sounds kind of interesting. So I plowed into it.
Did you find it? And I'm glad you did. I really enjoyed it. Is it weird? It's weird seeing number zero though. When you look like on Goodreads, it reads as number zero in the series, which is it's kind of strange.
Really, it says that?
It says number. It says number.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Number zero, unless it's a hashtag. I don't know. You know, nowadays you don't know if it's a damn number sign or hashtag.
I hope readers don't mistake that for a rating. Zero.
No worries there. It as well deserved. It's already very, very highly rated. Did you find it harder to go back and kind of dig? Had you always kind of had an idea about his childhood? How much character building in your mind do you do when you were writing these books?
Well, so many of the characters that Cork interacts with have already been shaped by all of the books in the series. So we've always known essentially who his mother was, who his father was, his grandmother Dilsey. The character of Sam Wintermoon is important through the stories, although he's dead through most of the stories. In this one, he's very much alive.
Right.
And of course, Henry Malou, the old, the ancient Mide, the Ojibwe healer, who is central to every Cork O'Connor novel. But he's much younger. In the current stories that I'm writing about him, he's 105. In Lightning Strike, he's a spry 60-year-old guy.
Y'all, whippersnapper!
So I've had a good idea of all of these characters all along, but it was fascinating for me to go back and explore them in a much younger time. I explored relationships that I knew were important, but I'd never really spent time exploring them. And then to take a look at Cork as a kid. I've done a couple of standalone novels in which I had 12, 13-year-old narrators for the stories, Ordinary Grace in This Tender Land.
Yeah.
So getting into the head of an adolescent male was pretty easy for me. I got to tell you, Dave, I'm a firm believer that males never mature much past 13 years of age. So
I agree with that one 100%.
Yeah.
Did you struggle with anything anachronistic in the book? Did you when I have one of the characters reach for his cell phone, or was that kind of strange for you?
Well, as I was creating the manuscript, the initial draft, I had no problems at all. But then my agent and my editors went through it and they found a few anachronistic things. A couple of them I went ahead and left in there because I'm thinking nobody's going to think it's anachronistic. I don't think it's anachronistic. But yeah, that's what editors are for, you know?
Those pesky editors.
Oh, I love those editors.
I bet. Sure. Do you lean heavily on your editors? Do they leave you alone? Like, how much work do they give you?
They are the most astute critics of my work that I have. Both my agent is a really fine critic, and I think I have the best editors in New York City. I rely on them heavily. I turn in a really good story to them. That's mm-hmm. I make sure I do that. But they help me fine tune it. And by the time we're all finished with it, their input has been so important in shaping it into that final product.
Nice. Have you been working with the same team all throughout these O'Connor books?
No, I've had, in my initial years, for my first three Cork O'Connor novels, I had five different editors. And then finally, I got a wonderful editor who was with me for about 15 years. And then she left. And the guy who's the head of the editorial department, a wonderful guy named Peter Borland, became my editor. And Peter just gets me. He's been my editor for maybe 5 or 6 years now. And he's just extraordinary. He and his assistant, Jean de Leon, they're just terrific.
How many of those original five did you fire?
I think I chased them away. Actually, Dave, each of them left to become a writer.
Oh, wow.
It's because they figured if Kruger gets published, anybody can get published.
It's like the family tree of William Ken Kruger. All these burnishing careers.
Yeah, maybe had a lot to do with their careers. Who knows?
Oh, man, that's funny. One of the things I really loved about this book, Lightning Strike, the nostalgia, the aspects to it with Corky. He rides a Schwinn bicycle. Of course, he has a paper route. It really brought me back. I didn't have a paper route, but I always wanted one. Did you ever have a paper route? Did you ride a Schwinn?
Never rode a Schwinn. Always wanted one. But I had three different paper routes. One in the morning, actually four different. I had two in the morning and two in the afternoon.
Oh, wow.
All of which I did with my brother, so made it easier. But yeah, I had paper routes when I was in middle grade schools and early high school.
Where was that? Where'd you grow up?
Those were the years I spent in Hood River, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Very nice. Was it one of those deals where you had like the big satchel and you walk around and sling them out?
You got a big canvas bag. Yeah. You folded your newspapers, you threw them up on the porch, or, there were those customers who actually tipped you and you made sure that you put their newspapers in the right place. But yeah.
And did you have it? And I know Cork in the book had some problems going around collecting money. Oh. Did you have that same issue?
Every paper, the bane of every paper boy, getting those deadbeats to pay me. I'll tell you that. At the end of the month, I was not good at that, honestly. And so I always took kind of a beating.
It's tough when you're somebody with a nice, you know, you're a nice guy. You go around, you're trying to, you got to be strict. You got to lay the hammer down. It's like when you're a teacher, they tell you, don't smile until Christmas. You know, so I'm guessing the same thing when you're.
They really tell you that?
Yeah. When you're a new teacher, they say, never let them see you smile until Christmas.
Oh, no.
No. It's not something that I could ever ascribe to, but, you know. I wouldn't be a teacher if that was the deal. If that was part of the bargain. No, forget it.
That was part of the fun, really, was tapping into my own childhood and giving Cork a lot of the elements of my childhood, making him a part of his childhood as well.
That's cool. He was also a bit of a reader. He was reading A Journey to the Center of the Earth for the fourth time in this book. Also, War of the Worlds. Were those the kind of books you were reading that influenced you?
Absolutely. Jules Verne, Arthur Conan Doyle, H.G. Wells. Loved those books when I was an adolescent.
That's interesting. And you don't write, science fiction. Is there a reason for that?
I like mysteries better. I matured, I guess. I don't know.
Have you ever tried to tackle a sci-fi book?
I never have. But there are certainly elements, otherworldly elements in the story.
That is true. That is absolutely true. It's mysticism for sure. And do you like writing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it comes to me fairly naturally.
Did you always want to be a writer? Were you walking around on your paper route thinking up stories?
Absolutely. As I tell audiences, I was blessed with parents who read to me when I was a kid. So I never went down for a nap. I never went to bed at night without a story being read to me. And for whatever reason, I grew up always wanting to be one of the storytellers. So yeah, I have always written.
That's awesome. Now, obviously, I love all the native elements in this book that we get. Again, some great Ojibwe characters and all the elements we come to expect from your books. Like, how did that kind of become a passion of yours as a writer?
Well, my choice to use the Ojibwe culture as a significant element of my Cork O'Connor stories, I got to tell you honestly, was a mercenary decision at first.
Really?
No, here's a confession coming from a mystery writer. Before I began to write mysteries, I didn't read them. That was the influence of my high school English teaching father, who convinced me that mysteries were the poor stepchildren of literature.
I didn't even read
Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys when I was growing up. When I decided I was going to write a mystery, I had a lot to learn. And one of the guys I stumbled across early was Tony Hillerman. For listeners out there who have no idea who Tony Hillerman was, he was an icon in the mystery genre. He wrote a series that was set in the Four Corners area of the Southwest and that deals significantly with the culture of the Diné, the Navajo. And I was just amazed by how seamlessly he wove this interesting cultural information into his stories. And I thought, well, nobody's doing that here in Minnesota with the Ojibwe. So I decided that's what I was going to do. I knew, like most white people, I knew absolutely nothing about this native group that we live shoulder to shoulder with. But I was a cultural anthropology major in college. And so the idea of learning about the Ojibwe was exciting. And so I began doing my research and finally making inroads in the Ojibwe community. And it has progressed from there.
That's cool. So you kind of, go into the community and become a part of that, it sounds like?
I wouldn't say I become a part of the community, but I certainly have friends in the communities who help me with my understanding of the Ojibwe culture.
That's great. Any of them read your books and point out all the errors that you made?
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever deadlines will allow, I try to have at least one of my Ojibwe friends read and vet the manuscript.
That's great. You ever try out a Ouija board? I know there's some Ouija boards in your book.
Yeah, didn't we all do Ouija boards when we were
Yeah,
kids?
It was awesome.
Wow,
yeah.
Mystical experience. Woo. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun incorporating that into the story.
Yeah, that was fun. I also used to have, you mentioned the sunfish sailboat. I used to love, I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay, and we had a little sunfish, so we'd take that sunfish out and get it. I remember you get it like right on the angle, and then you just kind of let it tip over into the water. Nothing greater than letting your little sunfish tip right over and you jump in the water and then you get to turn it over and do it all over again.
Fun for kids anyway.
Yeah. That's true. Did you ever a sunfish?
No, I was not the canoe was my vessel of choice on the water. But in terms of the story, it seemed like a reasonable choice to make.
I think it was, yeah. Now, in this book, you mentioned that Quirk, he says he does his best thinking while walking. What about you, William Kent Kruger? Where do you do your best thinking?
When I'm not in the house. So biking, walking, driving. Very often on long drives, that's all I do is work on plotting whatever manuscript I'm on. I'm thinking about it for hours and hours as I'm driving. Or when I'm biking, ideas come to me. Cork walks, but for me, more often than not these days, it's biking.
So when you're out exercising, so do you not like listen to it? Like when I go out for a run, I got audiobook in or music in, usually audiobook. Do you just like tune everything out and you just like kind of let your story seep in? Is that what you do then?
I don't, I don't listen. I don't have headphones or earbuds or listen to it. Well, for one thing, it's dangerous when you're on a bike to do that. I got to listen for traffic.
That's true. Yeah.
And for another, that's I want to keep my head clear for these other things.
Huh, that's cool. Do you have any interesting or different or unique kind of writing quirks?
I write, before the pandemic, I did all my writing in coffee shops.
Really?
I've never written at home except for now the pandemic has forced me to do that. But for 40 years, I've done all my creative work in coffee shops.
Huh. Really? Do you ever get recognized?
Yeah, a lot. Well, I'm not in the beginning, but yeah, a lot these days. And I get tracked down to, I was getting tracked down to my coffee shops. But for the most part, folks were pretty respectful.
Do you live in, is it like a smaller town you live in? They just kind of leave you alone?
I think it's just the Minnesota nice thing. So people, if I'm writing, if I'm working, they might approach me and say, excuse me, Mr. Kruger, I just want to say how much I like your work. That never bothers me. Or sometimes they'll ask me to sign a book that they have. The ones that bother me are the ones who say, Mr. Kruger, have I got a story for you? You're going to want to write this one down.
That's the word. How do you deal with that? Because, you can't just, foist them away. You got to be kind. How do you gently let them off the hook?
Well, generally, I'll listen and I'll say, that's an interesting story, but that's your story. You tell it.
Oh, very good. And they say, screw you. I can't write. You're the writer, guy. Make it work.
Well, that's never quite happened. But what I have done is point them to people I know who will write stories for money. You pay them and they'll write your story.
Oh, wow. There you go.
There are those folks out there. That's how they earn their living. Yeah. So, try to give directions in that regard. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So obviously a big part of your book is the father-son relationship. And I got a little choked up when you have Quirk's father said to him that he hoped that he would never wear a badge, meaning Quirk would never wear the badge. Do you ever find yourself, like, how invested in the characters do you get? Do you like go do a deep dive? Are you a method writer? Are you getting inside the head? Do you get emotional?
Well, writing is a very dissociative experience, Dave. you have to sink yourself deeply enough into the imagining of a scene so that you can experience it emotionally and find the words then that will convey that emotion to readers. At the same point, as an artist, you're standing outside that experience and you're making critical judgments about how you're going about it. And so that keeps me from getting too maudlin in terms of particularly the very emotional scenes. That's how I approach it.
Yeah. It was, I liked the way he dealt with it. And it was just great to be able to see him interact with his father and kind of learn from his father and then, almost grew up to be his father. Maybe you could say that in many ways. So. Really.
Well, I don't know about you, but a lot of the guys I know will not admit to it, but they're very like their fathers.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
I certainly am.
Whether you're not an English teacher, but in many ways, you know, you write books. So, I mean, that's
there. You go. There you go.
Not too.
I have the same appreciation for the power of language that my father had.
That's great. What's your kind of favorite part of the writing process? The brainstorming bit of it, or the editing, or just the first draft of it? What do you like the best?
Well, you just nailed it there. I love writing that first draft. I'm a very careful writer. I write slowly. And I try to get everything right in that first draft. I know Stephen King says, you know, you write to stay ahead of all the fear. That's not me. I write slowly and carefully. And that's the part I love the most. I hate revision. I know it's important, and it makes the story so much better.
Yeah.
But that's the most difficult part for me. Huh. But writing that first draft, when it can be anything I want it to be, and I have this beautiful image of what it will be, I love that experience.
That's awesome. I can tell your passion is coming through. How much of it do you have outlined or planned out, or how much do you let it just come organically?
Well, you know, mysteries are a very tightly woven fabric of storytelling. Everything depends so significantly on everything else. So when I'm writing a Cork O'Connor story, I think that plot through as completely as I can, generally speaking, before I put my fingers to the keyboard. So at the end of that thinking process, I know how the story begins. I know how it ends. I know who did what to whom and why. I know the themes I want to weave into the story. And then I sit down and it comes fairly easily to me then, because I spend a good deal of time thinking about it. I used to outline in the old days. I used to actually outline, but I don't do that anymore. I can hold the story fairly completely in my head now.
That's great. Yeah, it's funny. After you've written 18 of them, you know, I would think you can kind of start to be able to trust yourself and know that you can do it.
Yeah, you know, I don't. It's not like it's rote or anything, but what you do learn is to trust yourself, trust your instincts, and don't second guess yourself.
Yeah, that's great. All right, William Ken Kruger, it is time for our segment we call Quick Six, Six Quick Questions, in which we, that is I, find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Professor T, which is a... it's.
I don't know that one.
You'll find it on PBS. It's a BBC production about a quirky crime solver.
Huh.
Love that series. Love
really,
that series.
Professor T, any relation to Mr. T?
Absolutely not. This guy is about as far from Mr. T as you can get.
Is he British?
Yes. The original series actually is out of, I think, Belgium. It's out of Belgium. And it's BBC has remade it. And both of those different productions are stellar, just stellar.
All right, cool. I will look for that one, Professor T. Sounds good. How about this? What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Narnia.
Oh, sure.
Actually, yeah. I take that back.
Okay.
I want to live in the world that Tolkien created for The Lord of the Rings. Yeah. What a marvelous, magical place that was.
Absolutely, yeah. That would be... that's probably the number... You gave the number one and number 1A answer that we get.
I'll bet. Didn't we all grow up just loving being in that place?
Yeah, yeah. And they did such a good... Peter Jackson did such a great job with those
Absolutely.
Movies.
Absolutely. Yeah. Phenomenal translation to the screen.
Yeah. I would imagine a lot of pressure with so many fans to get it right, and he just absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
How about this? Can you give me one of your top five favorite movies of all time?
It's cliche, but The Wizard of Oz. Still love that movie.
Really?
Absolutely, I do. So The Wizard of Oz, The African Queen. God, I love that movie as well.
Yeah.
I love North by Northwest. Maybe my favorite Hitchcock movie. Let's see. What else? Red River, John Ford, John Wayne movie.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Have we hit five yet?
Well, no, I just needed one. You gave me four.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
How about this? How about a top five favorite book that you've read?
Yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird. Isn't it everybody's favorite book? Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Hard to go wrong with that one. And a great one when I was an English teacher to teach, for sure.
I'm glad you taught it. I think not enough kids coming up get exposed to that particular work. I know there are, you know, politically incorrect things about it these days. I get that. But it's right. still almost no. a perfectly told story.
It is 100%. And the kids really get into it. And it's so yeah. important for them to know that story and to read it and discuss it. So
yeah, good.
Yep. How about this? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I love singing the Everly Brothers. Dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I always sing when I can. That one and El Paso.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso. Yeah. You know?
All right. Awesome.
Those are my two.
Those are good ones. Those are great ones. Very good. And finally, William Kent Kruger, what book are you currently reading?
I have just finished reading, I lead a book group for my church, and the first book we're going to discuss in September is a book called Jim Henson, The Biography.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a biography of, you know, the guy who created the Muppets. We all know him, and it's just a fascinating portrait of a true original, a true artist. And I'm just learning a lot about this guy who I thought just did the Muppets, and he did so much more than that.
Huh, that's great. Very cool. All right. Well, listen, that's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for coming by. Loved your book, Lightning Strike. So, so good. Really packs an emotional wallop. And I think it's so great that you went back and we finally get the origin story of Cork O'Connor.
I'm glad I did it as well.
Take care now and enjoy. Hope the air quality is good up there. Are you able to get outside?
Well, you know, for the last couple of weeks, we've been dealing with all of the smoke from the Canadian fires, but we've had some winds that have blown things out. So finally, we're out from under the air quality alert.
All right. Very good. Very good. We're getting hit with the stuff from California right now.
It's terrible, man. Terrible. And you have your own wildfires in Colorado that are roaring, too. Oh,
always. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Anyway.
Yeah.
take care,
Dave.
All right, you too.
Thanks again. This was fun.
No, thank you. Appreciate it. It has been.
Bye-bye.
The Inside Flap. Okay, there you go. Man, I just had such a great time talking to him. So cheerful and full of life. Great conversation.
Now, is there any ice fishing in this book?
No, there is no ice fishing in this book. But, you know, there's 18 books in the series, so I'm sure some of them...
How can you have a book about Minnesota without ice fishing?
Well, it would have to be winter for it to...
You need to read some more of these books, Dave. Okay, we got to find out about the ice fishing.
I guarantee you there's one set in the winter.
All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some...
book reviews.
And let's start with...
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called The Plot by Jean Hanf Korelitz. Is how I'm going to pronounce that last name. K-O-R-E-L-I-T-Z.
Okay.
Korelitz.
Korelitz, sounds right.
So this book has something that I deeply love, which is the failed novelist / professor.
Oh.
I love this character type. Dave, you actually reminded me of this character type. If you
because
were running
I'm a failure?
What? 5 minutes late to your class,
yeah.
Not having a key,
right.
Running around, that kind of thing.
Yes.
so these are usually white men. They're messy. Mm-hmm. I think of Michael Douglas in the movie The Wonder Boys, shambling around unshaven in his lucky pink.
Oh, yeah, so
remember
great.
He had that lucky pink
the
bathrobe?
Pink bathrobe, yeah.
I think from one of his ex-wives. So these are, for some reason, they're my people. I like these people.
Yes.
So this book stars one of these people, Jake Finch Bonner, who wrote one excellent book. It was well reviewed. He had a lot of buzz. Since then, he hasn't published anything that was any good.
Oh.
And he's whiling his life away at a terrible creative writing MFA program teaching. And it just sounds like super unaffirming, you know, just
yeah,
sounds
yeah.
terrible.
Right.
So one session, he has a student who tells him that he's got a story idea so brilliant that the story will write itself.
Mm.
He says, this is a blockbuster. It's a done deal. I'm going to get movie and TV rights. I'll be everywhere. I will be famous and rolling in money once I write this. He tells Jake the plot. And Jake, who kind of doubted him, realized he's right.
It's all in.
This is brilliant.
Okay.
Do
you get to know what the plot is?
Not right away, no. So some time passes. Jake's writing career gets more and more dismal. Not better, not stays the same, gets worse. And he thinks, you know what? I never saw that book come out. So he digs around, looks online, and this student with, quote, the plot is dead. Ooh. And it appears that this student never published that book. So the story died.
Oh, Jake.
With the student.
Yeah.
So I think you can guess what
Jake's going to write that
book. A morally bankrupt, desperate,
nefarious,
yes, Andrew.
Shambling.
So now hang on here.
Uh-huh.
Whoa. Right?
So the thing is, if somebody tells you a plot for something, right?
Uh-huh.
And sure, the plot may be great, and that's the gimmick.
Uh-huh.
But you cannot patent a plot.
I know.
So it's not like he's really stealing it.
That's what he tells himself. So he writes this book. It's an instant bestseller. He's an instant multimillionaire. He's on Good Morning America. You know the drill. He gets a letter in the mail that says, you are a thief.
Oh.
And then from there, the story gets wild.
Yeah.
So the premise of this book is really fascinating. What plot is so perfect that it can't fail?
Right.
Also paired with Andrew's questions, what happens when you steal an idea from a stranger?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would imagine that's something it's out there in the ether if you tell somebody.
Well, and you know, and the guy died. Mm-hmm. Now, I personally, like, if that was me, I would have basically
dedicated the book to him, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or said something about it.
But if you're a guy who likes adulation, who wants, you know,
or thinks he's never going to get caught.
Yeah,
maybe the other
that's
thing.
The key. Yeah, knows he can get away with it.
This takes you down some dark paths. It's really good.
Mm.
And you get to know what the plot is
as
the story unfolds. Right. And it's really, it's a great plot.
It's a great plot.
This is an excellent, it's a very quick read. It's called The Plot by Gene Hanf Corlitz.
I wonder if someone will write that book. Are like experts from the book?
She ended up writing the book.
I see.
The book is within the book.
Oh, okay.
But it happens in real time as you know about the story.
I'm intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a producer, and this guy has produced some of the largest blockbuster movies.
I know who you're going to say.
And I'm not actually
going to
say the name.
You harp on this guy all the time.
I'm not
going to
say the name. I'm not going to say the name. But,
okay.
But basically, his movies have come out, and he's basically has taken, like his blockbuster movies, he's basically borrowed the plot, right, from other books, right? And he didn't give credit to or credence or anything like that, but... So I researched this, and like I said, it came up, and the justification is, well, sure, they're very similar to these other stories, but you can't copyright a plot, right? Sure, it's almost exactly the same storyline, but guess what?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's not that the idea is not protected.
Wow.
Well, and also, Shakespeare himself, you know, used other people's plots, so, and that's, you know, kind of one of the top 10 writers of all time. Top 100, he certainly cracks the top 500.
Let's say
that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, to quote Shakespeare, there is nothing new under the sun.
That's right. All right. So, nice. I like what you did there.
Thank you.
My book this week
is
When the Reckoning Comes by LaTanya McQueen. Now, Laura, we recently spoke to Zakiya Dalila Harris, the author of The Other Black Girl. She opened up her book with the quote that I think is apropos here, and that is, and we talked to her about this, black history is black horror. And that's definitely where this book falls under that kind of umbrella. This is the story of a black woman named Mira. Now, Mira left her hometown in North Carolina years ago. This is a small kind of segregated town that she grew up in. She had a troubled past with this town. In fact, when she was younger, she and a couple of her friends snuck onto the grounds of a plantation that was rumored to be haunted, only to discover a dead body there. And one of her friends who was with her, this black kid named Jesse, he was actually accused of murdering this body. or I guess you don't murder a body. You murder this.
Technically,
this,
no. Yeah.
The murder of this person. Well, now it is years later, and their white friend from childhood, Celine, is getting married. So it's time for a reunion in this town. Only guess where Celine's wedding is. Her
at
wedding.
The plantation.
Yes, is at the plantation called the Woodsman Plantation, which, of course, is now has been all fixed up. It is now a resort because that's what they do. And that's where people apparently go to get married on plantations.
Yeah, they do. You know, yeah. Someone famous who did is Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively got married on a plantation and then they had to apologize for it afterward.
Of course. Well, they well, they should have. Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Man, that's, mm-hmm. that's ridiculous. Well, I wonder, it turns out that on this plantation, there are ghosts of slaves hanging around. We get to meet them, and they are not happy. In fact, they are out for revenge.
Oh, when the reckoning comes.
Yes, exactly. This is a thrilling, surprising, horrific read that just kept the pages.
This sounds really
flying.
Good.
It
Where
is
was
really
I
good.
When
That's
you were
why
reading
I'm
this.
Recommending it.
Darn it. This sounds like something I would love.
You will love it. You can read it. Now, what's going to stop you? I don't know why you're yelling at me. The pages fly past. I love the mix of horror and history. It's done so well in this
cover.
Book. It's well written. And what I really love about this is like you are, it's not too often when you read a horror book and you're kind of rooting for the... you know, the ghosts, the evil spirits, quote unquote evil spirits. I don't want to say evil spirits, but the ghosts, you know, you're on their
definitely
side.
Definitely on the dead side of the dead.
So this is really, really good. I enjoyed it. It is called When the Reckoning Comes by LaTanya McQueen. Check it out.
Okay, that sounds good, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Andrew.
What plantation was that? Or where was it set?
It's in North Carolina, small town in North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina. You don't usually hear about the North Carolina plantations.
Mm-mm. Yep. Andrew, what do you got for us this
week?
Well,
surprise, surprise, I've got another space opera.
Okay,
Right. That means I get to play this again.
Still not tired of hearing that song, though.
Oh, yeah.
We have a record of Star Wars that I think Dave's parents gave us.
Yeah.
And so the other night, I like to play records while we eat dinner. I was like, we haven't listened to this yet. Right. Let me put this on. This is the worst record to try to eat supper to.
No, you don't want
to
listen
to
this.
It's like Attack of the Clones going on, all kinds of things, all kinds of drama.
Yeah.
I had to get up
really,
and turn it down like 3 or 4 times, and then I just had to stop it.
Very dramatic.
It's very dramatic.
The rising and falling action of the
Yeah. And Sylvia's just trying to tell us about like a history test.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Not something you want to listen to at dinner time.
I'm sorry, Andrew. Go ahead.
Okay. So the book I reviewed this week is Black Sheep. And the author is Rachel Aukes, A-U-K-E-S.
Is this based on the Chris Farley movie, Black Sheep? I don't believe that movie was a space opera, so probably not.
Yeah, probably not.
Would have been made better by being a space opera. Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not even similar to Spaceballs or, you know, any of those movies.
Any of those.
Yeah. So the book is part of the series. It's called The Flight of the Javelin. And the story here is there is a, you know, this takes place far in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is an Earth-based galaxy, but it is like far flung from Earth. And there's wars, and wars have been fought, and humanity has spread themselves throughout the, you know, the galaxy. And so the crew of this ship, they're leaving like this war-ravaged area. And it is this system where nobody trusts each other, right? I mean, it is just a brutal, violent system. And so, you know, a group of brave, I don't know if you call them immigrants, they decide to board a ship and take a 23-year journey to basically try and find a planet that they can call home, right? And try and create a more normal, more peaceful existence. And so,
how do they pick the 23?
Well, it's 23 years.
Oh.
The
okay.
journey's 23
How many
years.
People are doing it?
Well, I'll get to
oh,
that.
Oh,
I'll
sorry.
Get
to
that. Don't jump ahead. Man, she's really anxious.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like a good Netflix series that I might like to watch.
Good
so I was
point.
Just kind of curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Hold your, you know, and I guess in a way it's a little bit like Battlestar Galactica, right, where humanity is trying to find a place. But, you know, Battlestar Galactica, they're fleeing from like the androids.
I don't think I've ever seen.
I've never.
We have
watched
no idea.
An episode
I'm looking at you with a dumb face because I've never seen it.
So So the captain of the ship is Throttle.
That's
Ram.
Why you have that face. Okay. You're resting dumb face. Okay. You're RDF.
Okay.
It's Throttle Rain, and she goes by Throttle. And Throttle is a really interesting character, right? And so this ship is 15 of 23 years, right, on their journey.
Okay.
Now, the crew of the ship, and one of the things that's great is how human this crew is. They are not perfect. They've been pirates. They've been mercenaries, right? They have basically fought in the war. They fought on opposite sides of each other. I mean, they are about as flawed as you can get, the entire crew. Now, Throttle Rain is a woman. She is very inspiring. She actually does not have the use of her legs. And so she's paralyzed, but they've basically worked out some contraptions so that she can actually use her legs through, like, these robotic contraptions. Hmm. And she's able to function normally, I mean, really at a pretty high level, right? So she's able to, you know, that disability has not hindered her at all, right? And that's just Throttle Rain, and everybody in the crew, you know, is unique, right? And they have their own personal history, whether it's drugs or that they were pirates or, you know, whatever. And that's part of the fun is, you know, each person, as the story unfolds, it's like unpeeling an onion. You get to find out more and more about them. You know, and that's where the term black sheep comes from. It is a ship of black sheep, right? But together, right, they care about each other. They are a family. They are a crew. And so that is really one of the best parts of this book is really, right, it's the family, it's the crew. Now, this journey... there are 800 plus passengers in cryo. And so what they do is they have cryogenics, but, you know, and so they're basically in stasis. But once a month, they have to get woken up to basically stretch their legs and things like that. And then they basically go back into cryo again.
Right. Hmm.
So it's not like they can just sleep for 23 years. They have to get up one day a month to basically, you know, refresh themselves. And then they basically go back into stasis again.
I'd like to be put in stasis just to get caught back up again.
And when you're in, you don't age when you're in stasis, right?
Yeah, you don't age.
Right.
So I guess if we lived, if you could, for every 30 days, you would only have to age one day.
Sure.
So basically, if we could live to 100 years, I mean, basically, with this, you know, this math, you could basically live, 3,000 years? Is that math right?
I don't know, Andrew. Uh-huh. I don't know why you're looking at
a lot of math.
3,000 years.
A lot of math going on right now.
You know, so, you know, I mean, it's a
good concept.
It sounds like it. Like, if like one day, it doesn't sound significant, but when you actually think about a lifetime of doing that, right? I mean, you could live over 3,000 years. I mean,
I like that idea. It's interesting.
So
I feel like one day of moving around isn't going to help you, though. You're still going to fall when you get out.
You know, and it's, hey, it's science fiction.
Being overly,
you know, but it is true. But it is somewhat. It's more realistic
I'm just
than thinking
think of how I can do this
than thinking you could just go into just
trying to get to it's get true.
Stasis
get into
for
it.
20 yeah. for 23 years. So the small crew has to maintain, right, and they have to rotate and they have to take care of the people in cryo, and you know, and so the book starts off. This is the premise. Then there's an emergency flood, right, and they can't explain how it's happened. But the flood basically puts the passengers in danger, right? And so the crew, like, you're learning about this crew as they're responding to this emergency. Hmm. You know, the captain shows up, the mechanic shows up, right? And you're learning about them, right? And you learn more about the situation. And so then they figure the flood stuff out. They get that sorted out. And then, of course, they realize, well, the ship's off course. It's like, okay, well, let's put it back on course. So they put the ship back on course. And then, of course, they have a cat. And a cat is a catastrophic failure.
Really?
They call it a cat.
Oh. I thought it was a real cat.
No.
I got excited.
Well, it's a catastrophic failure, cat. Okay. And so basically, the catastrophic failure shuts down the ship. Well,
Did you think it was a real cat?
Well, yeah, because
they have a cat?
Yeah, because of...
Red Dwarf, right?
Red Dwarf,
I
where
know.
There is a cat.
There's a cat that something
was
made
in
him...
stasis.
Turned him into a human.
Yeah.
Well, no, this is a catastrophic failure.
All right.
So,
thanks for getting us all.
So basically, they have
reason.
To.
I love.
So they
Dwarf.
Have to.
Yeah.
So they respond to the cat. They basically put, they put the people in cryo. They put them in a room that's heated, and they basically have to take the backup ship out to try and find a way to rescue the ship. So they're not abandoning the ship. They put the ship in like shutdown mode. They turn on these portable heaters. They put everybody together. So it's like, you know, we have, you know, so much time now where we really need to go and find, we need to find help. And, you know, but their hope of help isn't very great, right? I mean, they're, you know, just in the middle of nowhere, literally. But what else can they do?
Yeah.
And so, you know, here they are in the backup ship. And of course, what happens? They find an abandoned spaceship that could just very well be the answers to their salvation. And so the ship is it's a mystery ship. It has been abandoned for 300 years. It has an artificial intelligence who has holes in its memory. And basically it has used in the last 300 years, it's used its robots and stuff to fix itself up. So the ship is largely functional. It's largely intact, but it's still missing a lot. And the ship it's more advanced. It's faster. It is a stronger ship. Now the ship has no weapons, but it is a ship really with enough capabilities that they can probably use it to save the emigrant ship. I guess they've got names for those, like those big spaceships they use for, like, you know, the migrant ships, those kinds of things. And so basically, and I won't give too much more away from the story, but what I will say is, you know, this is also a typical out of the frying pan into the fire. And a lot of books that are out of the frying pan into the fire, they keep putting the crew, you know, or the characters into more and more impossible situations, right? And I get frustrated by that because it's just like, man, one, give these poor sods a break.
Yeah.
You know? And it's also like, and it just ratchets up and ratchets up. But this book doesn't do that, right? There's enough balance in here. There's enough good. There's enough balance for this. But, it is a frying pan into the fire type of situation. But the author really balances it out extremely well. That, you know, even for an anxious person like me, I really enjoyed this book.
He's very anxious.
I enjoyed the journey.
I know what he means, though. Because we read thrillers, and some thriller books, there's too many twists.
Yeah.
It's too much. It's one thing after another. And I don't know if authors, publishers know, like, it's not pleasant to read at a certain point.
At a certain point, it is not.
Yeah, but I think they do know because the successful ones that are good, aren't like that.
Don't have that.
And you think of the most successful stories, and and there's the excitement and stuff like that too, but there's also
a lot of downtime,
and there's some levity, and there's some other stuff built in. Yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds good, and that is recommended by
Andrew Dowd,
which means it's time for the audiobook of the week, and this week my pick is "Who They Was" by this author. His name is Gabriel Krause, and he reads the book, which is a lot of fun. An in-your-face, up-close, and personal account of a young man living a dual life. On one hand, he goes to university, and is set in London, by the way. He studies English literature and goes by Gabriel. Also, you'll note the author's name. So this is actually based on his life.
Really?
So it says. Huh. Interesting fun fact about Gabriel. He's got the name of his book tattooed on his hand, "Who They Was," in nice big letters tattooed on his hand.
Wait, are Gabriel the writer or the
guy
the
who wrote
character?
This book? No, sorry, the author of this book.
Huh.
Yeah. And then, of course, on the other hand, he goes to university. He is also in a gang. He lives that street life in the hood and goes by the moniker of Snoops. This book is hard-hitting and confrontational. The story is autobiographical, so all the gang stuff that you hear comes across as very realistic. The way he writes and the way he reads it is great. I really want to hear him read it. It sounds so natural. He's got all the lingo and the jargon. You really feel like you're part of this world. And he sounds the part. He's got that great London accent.
It's not a bad idea to do that on your hand because you're going to get asked about it all the time.
Yeah, what's your book? Just hold up your hand.
Just hold up your hand. No, they're going to ask you, what does that mean?
Yeah, what a great, it's like, a marketing
Yeah, that's
ploy.
What I meant, sorry.
Yes, that's perfect. I see. What's that on your hand, cuz? Oh, Gov?
Yeah.
It's who they was. That's my book. You want to read it? Great idea.
Go buy it.
Better idea. Listen to it. Yeah. Go buy it.
Yeah.
You know, the character
and
Snoop.
You'll get asked about that your whole life.
Your whole life. But what if he writes an, I guess a, for the next book, maybe he gets it on his other hand.
There's and plenty then start, of flesh.
Plenty of flesh. A pound of flesh. You know, if I came across this guy, Snoop's, on the street, I would have to say I would be very scared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a scary cat. The author does a great job also at showing what it is about gang life that appeals to these poor young kids growing up. It's just kind of the sheer poverty and desperation that they're dealing with. What it's like to live in public housing is on full display. There's robberies that are described in great detail, as well as stabbings. And it's all done with the language of the street, the terminology that just kind of shapes this world. So although this guy is violent, unabashedly so, I found his story very interesting to listen to. I kept listening because I really just wanted to see what kind of life he would end up with. You know, he was going to university, but he was also going out and robbing people and stabbing people. You know, how's it going to turn out? If you're, you know, not squeamish about violence and always wondered what goes on in the mind of a gangster, check this one out. This is Who They Was. Let's take a listen to a clip. Written and performed by Gabriel Krause.
So I snap her finger back. It folds straight over so the tip touches her wrist in one go. And it's strange because I always thought that if you break someone's finger, you'll actually feel the bones break, hear it even. But I don't feel anything at all. It's like folding paper, as if the finger was naturally supposed to bend back like that. And she's screaming to me, take it, just take it. But I can't. In fact, within seconds, I can see the break beginning to swell up the base of her finger, and now I know I'm definitely not getting the ring off. And the door opens again, and there's a man standing there in a red sweater, and we know it's all fucked now. We have to get away, but we're still hoping we can at least cut out with something to show for our efforts. And the man grabs his wife around her waist and pulls her towards him, drags her into the doorway, while Gotti's like, Snoops, come, fuck this, we need to cut, blood.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook of the week.
Audiobook of the week, and that is our show for this week. Thanks so much to William Kent Kruger for spending some time with us. His book is Lightning Strike. Cork O'Connor number 0, according to Goodreads.
Nice.
Check it out. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you later.
Adios.
I have never met a man so ignorant that I couldn't learn something from him. Galileo Galilei.
Well, I have some people I can introduce him to.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso.